This is a guy who inspired two generations of heroes, my folks and myself included. We had to hide who he was. Because white men in masks are heroes, but black men in masks are scary.
Thank God times have changed.
Yeah, thank God.
All right, welcome back to the Cephalopodcast. This is episode 7, where we are discussing season 1, episode 7, which is entitled An Almost Religious Awe. And the phrase "an almost religious awe" is, I believe, a direct quote from the original comic, where after Dr. Manhattan essentially ends the war in Vietnam, he mentions that the people of Vietnam looked up to him in an almost religious awe because he is a godlike figure, especially in Vietnam. He transforms himself to be, I forget, like 80, 90, 100 feet tall. So he was very imposing, which is how he was able to end the war. But it caused the people of Vietnam to revere him. So the episode opens and we see like a little mini documentary about Dr. Manhattan. And it's just talking about what Dr. Manhattan's contributions to humanity in this universe. There's a quick mention of some lithium watches and cars that run on lithium because energy is cheap and efficient in this universe, thanks to Dr. Manhattan. So we're just getting like a 50s style documentary about him. And then it mentions that the Vietnam became the 51st state thanks to Dr. Manhattan, because after Dr. Manhattan ended the Vietnam War, Vietnam became a united state. And we slowly see the camera pull back from this documentary, and we see there's a newspaper that says Manhattan leaves Earth for Mars. So I always make note of the newspapers. So at least according to everyone else, again, we haven't seen Dr. Manhattan since the original comic in this universe. He has gone to Mars. We see the TV that's displaying this mini documentary is inside of like a comic book shop or a video rental store. And the TV is surrounded by a cardboard cutout of Dr. Manhattan, which I looked up online and was actually drawn by Dave Gibbons, which is the guy who drew the entirety of the original comic. So the TV show was able to get him to come back and draw a quickie Dr. Manhattan for this scene, which I thought was kind of cool. We see some VHS tapes on a spinner. And one of the ones that I noted was Fog Dancing the Movie, which according to this VHS cover, was the winner of Best Picture that year. And it was directed by David Cronenberg. And if you remember from the farm episode with the eggs, the lady that was sitting on the porch was reading a copy of Fog Dancing the Book. So, which is not a real book. It's not a real anything. I don't believe it's an in-universe sort of joke. But it does exist here. Apparently it was a book and then it was adapted into a movie. Ultimately, they spin around past a couple of other tapes that were interesting, but we end on a Sister Night tape. And we see a little black girl who's probably, I don't know, 8, and she rents it. And the cover of the Sister Night tape is very reminiscent of, I would say, a 50s blaxploitation film. And ultimately, we learn later that this is a young Angela Abar and that we are in Vietnam. So this is Angela's, essentially, her origin story as a child. Do you want to talk about, after she leaves the video store, they're having a little festival out on the street. Do you want to talk about the street?
Yeah, so she walks out into like a street fair with lots of Dr. Manhattan paraphernalia and cosplay. And there's a needle drop, Living in America by James Brown, which came out in 1985. So this is smack dab in the middle of the 80s. We see an Asian dude performing with a puppet of Dr. Manhattan with a cynical look on his face and with what looks like an injury to his eye. The puppet lowers in front of a background that says An Almost Religious Awe, the title of the show. So it's like all, keeping in line with all the episodes having the titles sort of embedded in the scenery as large letters, you know. And so let's see. The black girl, we assume, is Angela Abar, brings the VHS tape to her parents.
Oh, real quick before we get too much farther on, the fact that there's a Dr. Manhattan puppet here is a reference to the original comic where Dr. Manhattan tells Lori that humanity, that they're all just a bunch of puppets. And Lori kind of pushes back on him, like, really? And he was like, well, I'm a puppet too. I'm just a puppet that can see the strings. So it's a reference to him, you know, in essence, being omnipotent and being able to see things outside of, you know, I would suppose like the range of human, you know, visibility or whatever. But he does make reference that he is a puppet. So the fact that he is an actual physical marionette in this, I think, is just a throwback to that, which I thought was kind of cool.
What does it mean that he's a puppet? Who's controlling him?
Well, that's, again, I don't want to go too much into it because I think that's where the rest of this episode goes and the rest of the show goes a little bit.
But like when he's talking in that scene, like what is he talking about? I don't need to know, like,
In the scene, I haven't read that part of the comic in a while, but I believe he's just basically talking. So Dr. Manhattan exists sort of outside of time and space. He experiences all timelines at the same time. So he's frustrated trying to talk to and deal with humanity. He's having a relationship with Lori Blake, but it's hard for him to have human-like relationships because he sees the beginning, the middle, and the end of the relationship all at once. So he gets frustrated having to limit himself to communicate with humans in a linear fashion. And so he basically, it's really, he's kind of insulting humanity. He's like, you guys are just puppets, man. He's like, you're just getting up, you're putting in the motions, you know, you don't have any real original thoughts. Somebody else is just sort of like dragging you through life. And, Lori's young. I think she's, whatever, 20 in that. She's just frustrated. And she's like, what the hell are you talking about? She's like, you know, you're not so much better than us. And I think sort of as a way to placate her a little bit, he says, well, I'm a puppet too. I'm just a puppet that can see the strings. Like I realize that I'm part of, you know, whatever this bigger thing that's going on. I'm just aware of it. You know, you guys think you are special and unique and part of this, you know, big cosmic experiment, but you're really not. You're just puppets is what he's saying.
I would think, I guess I would like interpret it maybe as a reference to determinism. Like,
sure.
Even him is the most powerful, omnipotent, somebody who's like beyond space and time. He still can't like change the passage of time and what happens. Like he can't change the future. He can't change the past. He's witness to determinism, and so he sees all that. Whereas humans can't see that. Maybe I don't know.
I think that's a really good point because ultimately, in the original comic, he was not aware of what Veidt was doing and what Veidt was planning to do with the squids and kill 3 million people. In essence, Veidt outsmarted him. So it's he has his limitations. He is very powerful, but even he has his limitations. And I think he's, you know, maybe acknowledging that a little bit. I'm not sure. And mm-hmm. it's much more apparent as this episode and this show goes on what he's talking about here. And I don't want to go too much into it because I think it'll spoil it, but we'll talk about that probably in the next episode, I think.
Okay. Yeah, where were we? So like
you were talking about determinism and like that's what I started to say was that
we should maybe explain Dr. Manhattan's, determinism is for people that are listening to this that are obviously listening and want to know
and we're not talking
may
to ourselves.
May or may not know. It's just the idea that physics, the rules of physical matter can be predetermined given enough information. So like even your thought processes, even your actions as humans, given that we have, you know, we think we have free will, may come down to all like down to the molecular level as predetermined. So everything that happens physically in the physical space throughout time is predetermined because it's all just comes down to the rules of particles and elements and everything. And so that would, that's a philosophical idea that that's kind of, I don't know, debates the idea of free will.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's sort of the debate of free will versus what, you know, fate or whatever, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What, that's what I started saying. I got a little off track. Was basically, I mean, Dr. Manhattan has the power to be able to see what Veidt was planning. He can see the beginning and he can see the end, and he could have theoretically determined that Veidt was going to drop a squid on New York and kill 3 million people, and he could have stopped him. But Veidt essentially outsmarts him. So, sure, there is a level of determinism there in that maybe.
Well, then what
Dr. Manhattan does have some limitations.
What actually happens is, what, like, does Adrian Veidt have some sort of like crazy device that's able to change like time and space?
He ultimately ends up making a machine that I want to say it sort of scrambles or it shuts down Dr. Manhattan's powers. So he's able to see what Adrian Veidt is doing. I mean, sort of like, I guess it's like a dampening field, kind of. Like, he puts up the, he builds, it's all off screen. You never see any of it. This is where it sort of comes into the story that Adrian Veidt's the world's smartest person. Because he's, you know, sort of like how he can make space suits out of suits of armor. And anyway, so that's where a lot of that comes from. He makes this.
He doesn't come off as smart in this show, I got to say. But we'll see.
That's what ends up happening is that Adrian Veidt makes this, I guess, I don't even, they never show it or anything. They just talk about it.
So he makes like he Faraday makes this cage thing that for,
essentially, for yeah, there you something. Go. It's a Faraday cage and he's not able to see what he's doing. And Veidt, you know, summons a squid. And by the time Dr. Manhattan figures out what it is, it's too late.
Cool.
All right. So that was a long side note. So we see this puppet and then we see Angela, and she's taking the tape to her parents, right?
Yeah, the VHS tape to her parents, and they say she has to wait until she grows up. Her dad says people who wear masks are dangerous, you know, evoking the memory of his father, Will, who was Hood at Justice, and his trauma with that whole, with his father kind of, I think, leaving, and much of it was because of his Hooded Justice shenanigans, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. His line is people who wear masks are dangerous, Angela, and we should be scared of them. And she questions him. She says, why? And he says, well, they're hiding something. So she's just a little kid, man. She sees this badass looking black girl on the cover of this VHS tape. And she wants to watch it because she thinks that it looks cool. And her dad is like, no, this lady has a mask on. It's a story for adults. You should be afraid of people in masks. Like, whoa. I go, okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so she walks back, and we see shots of the crowd, and there's the Dr. Manhattan puppet guy, or no, sorry, shots of the crowd and the Dr. Manhattan puppet interspersed with shots of the Tulsa Massacre, as well as memories from the last episode with Will. Like one of them was of the bodies being dragged behind the police car. And then we see back in the fair, we see the Asian man who had the puppet running towards the camera, yelling something. And then we see a big explosion.
Yeah. So he's a suicide bomber, right? And he yelled something about, you know, infidels or whatever. He's just clearly not happy. And Angela's parents are standing, I don't know, what, 20, 30 feet from where this bomb went off. So they end up getting killed. You actually see the explosion kind of like envelop them. And Angela basically watches the entire thing. So she watches her parents get blown up. It's got to be crazy traumatic, right?
Yeah.
Oh, and then Angela wakes up, you know, right after the explosion, you know, present day adult Angela wakes up and her ears are ringing. And she's in Lady True's, you know, facility, and Lady True says that, oh, Agent Blake called to have me save you because it's my drug. You OD'd on nostalgia and it's my drug, so they, you know, they called me up for, you know, the treatment essentially. And Angela looks down and she has like this, like, really, she has this big tube, like it looks like an IV, but it's big. It's probably like a half inch around, like this rubber tubing. And Angela's like questioning. She's like still sort of shell shocked about coming off this nostalgia. And
I think, doesn't Lady True say that, she asked her a couple of questions, and Lady True said, if this is the fifth time you've asked me that, like, she keeps coming out of this and going back in.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Lady True basically says, okay, I'm going to give you, I'm going to give you a tutorial injection. And she gives her an injection in her arm, you know, to Angela's, against Angela's wishes. And it sort of like cuts to, you see, you know, in essence, you know, inside of Angela's head, you see, and it says, so you've taken someone else's nostalgia. Like, they have this whole like program for people that have OD'd on nostalgia. And, you know, here's how you do this treatment. Mm-hmm. And so they basically, you know, run through the basics of what nostalgia is and how it, you know, works in your brain. And then Angela comes out of it. So we get, it's sort of like an on-screen way to explain, you know, how nostalgia works and how they're going to, you know, clear this up, which she then makes mention that this big rubber tube is connected to a natural host, is what Lady True says. And Angela says, my grandfather? ? And Lady True doesn't answer. She doesn't want to go into that. Angela really wants to talk to her grandfather. She's just been through all of his memories, you know, traumatic memories. And her Lady True was like, well, no, that's not a good idea. Like, you're still coming off of this drug. And she says, you wouldn't know where he ends and where you begin. So she's clearly, I mean, she's dealing with her own memories. She's dealing with memories of herself young in Vietnam. She's dealing with her grandfather's memories. She's a very jumbled person right now and trying to confront her grandfather about all these weird visions that she just saw would just complicate things.
We hear a chime after their conversation on the intercom, and it says, good morning. It is now 12 hours until the Millennium Clock is activated. Please report to your assigned stations. Don't really know what that means. We don't know about the Millennium Clock being activated, what that is. I don't think. Maybe we have a hint, but we cut
to... I mean, at the very end, she explains what she's doing with a Millennium Clock, but there's no explanation of what the machine is or how it does it.
Yeah, there's some explanation there, yeah. So we cut to outside the treatment or the facility, and her husband, Cal, is driving up and... He drives up next to another car with Red Scare and the pirate lady and the husband.
Pirate Jenny.
Okay. Husband asks about her and they say she's still here and tell him to go home. He drives up to the gate and starts to ask to see his wife. The gate guard gets a call and pulls out a big ring thing and puts it on the ground. And a hologram appears above the ring and it's Bian, she says that the timing is bad because of the Millennium Clock and they can't grant access to unauthorized personnel. He asks if she's okay. Bian says, yes, she's responding well to the treatment.
Yeah, we see Blake in her car and she's got like an old school tape recorder and she's listening to a recording that she's made and we hear Angela's voice, adult Angela's voice. And she's saying a lot of the things that Will said in the last episode. So while Angela was in this, you know, nostalgia-induced fever dream or whatever, she was talking out loud and they were recording her. So Agent Blake is now aware of a lot of Will's shenanigans, I should say. You know, so she has him on tape, you know, admitting to some things. And so Agent Blake's just sort of listening to this, and she gets a call from Petey, and Petey's at Looking Glass's house, and he says, I don't remember exactly what he says, you know, hey, you remember when you sent me over here to investigate the 7th Cavalry and see, you know, if Looking Glass had a connection? And Agent Blake says, yes, Petey, I remember it as if I said all of that to you verbatim. And I thought that was just a cool way for them to sort of in-universe poke fun at that old TV trope of where, you know, in essence, the main character looks directly at the camera and tells you the plot. You know, you would never do that in real life. I would never say, hey, Jason, remember that time yesterday you sent me that email and asked me these three questions? Because of course you're going to remember that. Like, you lived it, right? It's the only reason that you would do something like that is to further along the plot, to tell a story to an audience that is not aware of that. So when she says, yes, PD, I remember it as if I said it all to you verbatim, I think it was just a cool way of them acknowledging that they had to use this trope to advance the plot, but they weren't super happy about it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we see five, or we cut to Looking Glass's bunker, I guess is the right word for it. And Petey is in there, and there are five 7th Cavalry members dead on the ground. One of the 7th Cavalry member is not wearing a mask. So there are four 7th Cavalry guys in masks and one not, but five are dead, and Looking Glass is nowhere to be found. And if you remember the last time we saw Looking Glass, he was walking into his house and the 7th Cavalry were following him in to jump him after they explained the whole squid conspiracy to him. So the 7th Cavalry and Wade clearly not getting along. The implication here is that he killed several of them. Petey says, it's kind of strange considering he's a cop that he didn't call this in, huh? So not only are there five 7th Cavalry members dead in this shed, bunker, whatever, there was no report of it. It's not out on the police scanners. Like, he just happened to be over there to check on him, and he walks in on this. So clearly there's some hijinks have ensued.
Mm-hmm. We cut to Blake. She gets out of her car and she approaches Judd's wife, Jane Crawford, on a horse out in the field, you know, supposedly next to their house. Then they go inside Jane's house. Blake bluntly says, I know who killed your husband. It was Will Reeves, Angela's grandfather. Blake says Angela talked a lot under the OD of nostalgia. Will Reeves was hooded justice, and the whole story we saw... So she kind of repeats the story we saw in the last episode. She says Angela kept saying the word Cyclops, which was a racist group who used mind control. Blake floats some ideas that the 7th Cavalry is Cyclops by another name, and that Judd was a secret white supremacist. And the ultimate plan was to have Joe Keen become president. Jane says, well, that was the plan until things went awry or something, and then starts to click a remote a bunch of times. After the fifth click of this remote, Blake's couch falls through the floor, and we hear a pretty obvious crash sound effect.
I love the fact that it's a super old-timey remote. Like, it's not a remote with, you know, like rubber buttons and, you know, you would see on a modern TV. Like, it's, I don't know, it looks like something from a TV from like the 50s, right? Yeah. I think it had three buttons on it, and they're all, you know, they're all Bakelite or whatever that old plastic was. Like, and it's clearly like half defective. It doesn't really work. Like, it's just this super old timey like remote. I don't know why, but a couple things on that scene real quick. Agent Blake is talking about, you know, that Angela Abar's grandfather killed her husband, and she explains Will Reeves was Hooded Justice, the very first masked vigilante. And she says, you know, he was the first one. He inspired a lot of people, including me. So she has some reverence for Hooded Justice. And she mentions he had to hide who he was because white men in masks are heroes, but black men in masks are scary.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's a little bit of a soft spot in Agent Blake's heart for Will Reeves just because of, you know, who he was. But now she knows he's a killer, so she's a little conflicted here. But I did think that was a good line about how, you know, all of the original Minutemen, I mean, they were all white guys. They had nothing really to hide. I mean, but, you know, yeah. Hooded Justice, his whole life was on the line. I mean, a black guy can't be a vigilante. It would have been bad news, so...
Yeah, that makes sense.
We see Angela. It cuts back to Angela, and she's in Lady True's facility still, and she's looking out the window at the Millennium Clock, and it is spinning, you know, ever so slowly. The top of it is moving around. Bien comes in, and she holds up a couple, like, flashcards, and she says, which man looks more trustworthy? And she goes through a couple flashcards, you know, just to gauge her, you know, mental responsiveness, I guess. And Angela's a little confused. She's like, what does this have to do? Like, does this have to do with my recovery or what? And Bien says, it's research for my dissertation. It's on the adaptive function of empathy and the role of rage suppression in social cohesion. You're like, whoa. Because, I mean, I don't know. Bien's supposed to be, I don't know. How old do you think Bien is? 15, 14, maybe? But she's got a dissertation already.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. Yeah, she's pretty young.
It cuts real quick, and we see there's a bunch of kids. This is young Angela Abar back in Vietnam. We see a bunch of kids, and they are painting, like, Dr. Manhattan, like, Russian babushka dolls or whatever those, like, nesting dolls are. At least that's what I thought they were. And the who's ever running this orphanage comes and basically pulls Angela off of this, you know, craft table, grabs her by the ear, and, like, drags out. Like, you think she's in trouble. Like, this who's ever running this orphanage, this lady's kind of a bitch. And the cops come and they interrogate her about the bombing that killed her parents. And they ask her to ID this. You saw the guy that did this, who did, you know, who gave the bomb to the guy on the bike. And she says, oh, yeah, I saw him. Yeah, I know what his voice sounds like. Yeah. And there's during this, there's a lot of flashbacks and flash forwards to her grandfather's time. So we see her grandfather getting his badge and how that relates to Angela getting her badge. We see her grandfather with a hood on his head. We see, so there's, she's still coming out of this nostalgia. There's a lot of her memories are still very muddled, but ultimately it cuts back to young Angela. And she says, you know, she wants to watch them interrogate this suspect, the police officers, and they shoot her down. They're like, no, you're too young. And then around the corner, like, a shot is heard. Like, they have just straight up executed this guy after Angela has essentially, you know, ID'd him. So they had no time or patience for anything that this guy was doing, you know, that this little, whatever, 8-year-old girl says he was the guy, and they just straight up executed him.
Yeah.
And let's see. I'll cover the next scene real quick. And then it cuts back, and Angela comes to again, and we're back in the Lady True's property. And Bien asks her what memories she's experiencing. She says, are you experiencing your memories or your grandfather's? How are you feeling? She's just kind of checking on her. And I noted this one line because it comes up later. She says, I have these dreams sometimes. They feel so real. I'm an old woman. I'm scared. And it hurts. So this is confusing coming out of this girl's voice or this girl's mouth because she's 15 and she's having dreams of being an old woman. And in the previous episode, Bien woke up in the middle of the night and she was scared, remember? And she went and tracked down her mom, and her mom was essentially cold to her. So, you know, she's talking a little bit more about what she's going through. Bien is sort of connecting with Angela because they're sort of going through the same thing. They have these dreams that are coming to, you know, that she's visualizing, and she doesn't know how to process them. Ultimately, we'll talk a little bit more about that later.
There was a cool transition. Angela says it hurt too when she had her memories. So it, like, there's some significant or like revealing that Bien is being treated with nostalgia, I think, is pretty clear at this point. Because mm-hmm. there's like weird memories she's having, and they kind of share an experience with that. And then it fades into Angela's eyes into like these weird stained glass windows. I thought that was kind of a cool shot, which goes into like this cathedral, and it appears to be Veidt's castle. And there is like a trial going on. The game warden is the judge. The court is filled with clones as the prosecutor and the audience. Veidt is in his costume. The prosecutor starts her closing statement. Basically, she says that he broke the main rule is you must not leave. They also talk about Veidt using this giant monster and killing 3 million people and showing no remorse. So, like, this is sort of a total judgment on Veidt as a person, I guess. She then talks about how he used us, the clones. So she's a clone as the prosecutor. They used us to try to escape. The game warden says Veidt chose to defend himself and gives him a chance to say his last closing statement. Stands up and lets out a huge fart. The judge has a mustache, which I noted, which I don't know if it just seems weird. He doesn't seem to be a clone, although he kind of looks like a Mr. Phillips.
I was going to ask you if you've, yeah, so the courtroom is filled with Crookshanks and Phillips.
Yeah.
And the game warden is the judge. And like you said, he's got like a Zorro mask on and he's got a mustache.
Yeah.
And he's not happy with Veidt because they basically, Veidt has admitted to killing a bajillion people and he shows no remorse.
Right. Yeah.
Veidt has chosen to defend himself. There's no attorney for him, but he doesn't offer any testimony or evidence. In fact, when they finally, you know, give him a chance to speak, he stands up and just cuts this huge fart and then says, "The defense rests," because he is just completely fed up with the whole concept of this trial. He's not taking it seriously. And it's worth noting that that when the scene opens, they say that this is day 365 of the People versus Adrian Veidt. So he's been on trial for like an entire year.
I assume
is part of the reason he's fed up with this. So anyway, I don't want to steal your thunder. Who do you think the game warden is?
I don't know. I think that it's undetermined. It could be a Mr. Phillips. He looks like it, but slightly different. You know, he's disguised, okay. So it's hard to say. But
yep.
they don't seem to indicate one way or the other. What does he say? Like, okay, they're talking to the jury and saying they aren't of his peers, and says he has an alternative jury and brings out a bunch of small pigs, and with a pig squealing in his hand, the judge in his hands, he's got a pig and it's squealing. He starts chanting guilty, guilty, and everyone starts chanting that. And Adrian lets down a small tear, it looks like, and we fade into his statue at Lady True's compound.
Yeah, there's a cool transition there where it, after he's found guilty, like it sort of zooms in on his face. And then it does a cut slash fade to the gold statue that Lady True has of Veidt, which I thought was kind of a cool, like, cinematic look.
Yeah, I'm still not sure what to make of it. We're getting near the end. I'm not, you know, I don't know.
Let's talk about that at the end, because that's a good theme for sure.
Yeah.
So we're now back in, I guess, you know, Angela's present. She's still hooked up to whatever this big rubber tube is. She traces the cord that she's hooked up to, I guess, a room next door. But the door is locked and she can't get in. She pounds on the door. She thinks her grandfather is in there. Right about then, Lady True walks by and asks her if she's hungry. And she says, yeah, okay, sure. And then they go eat something. And I did note that as the camera cuts past what they're eating, was it octopus on that tray, or was it squid?
Did you see that? Looked like some sort of squid or
octopus. Like, that's such a weird thing to serve, like squid, like, okay, whatever.
And they had a fish bowl on the table with a fish, which was weird.
Yeah, an actual fish. Yeah, right. Lady True says, I have a secret plan to save humanity, and it starts in Oklahoma. And Angela's not sure what to make of that. You know, she's still not sure if she trusts Lady True. She's trying to feel her out and see if she's, you know, going to be honest with her. And when she says that she has a plan to save humanity, I think Angela trusts her even less. Because, I mean, as far as Angela's concerned, humanity's not under threat. And nobody knows, apparently, except for Lady True. So we shall see. And she mentions that they're talking about Angela's husband. And Lady True mentions, that Cal had a major car accident a long time ago, and he has no memory of his life before that. And I think Lady True says, that's really weird, because people don't have amnesia. That's not a thing. That's a movie thing. Like, this isn't real. And Angela says, yeah, it does happen, and it did happen to me. She just, you know, she's not playing along. And she wants to know, or Angela wants to know, how Lady True knew so much about her husband. And Lady True responds, well, your dad told me. And Angela says, well, that's bullshit, because I've only known my dad for 20 minutes, and I certainly didn't tell him any of this. And she says, well, he's been watching you for a long time. So Will has been keeping an eye on Angela, sort of from a distance, for quite a while.
Yeah, I didn't really catch that about her husband, I guess, about the amnesia. It kind of flew by really quickly for me. But it
comes up later in the episode, so we'll talk about it. So basically, as far as Cal is concerned, he doesn't have any, you know, he doesn't have any memory before, I'm just going to make up a number. Say if he's 35 now, he doesn't have any memory before 30. So he's only has recent memory is what she's saying. And Lady True thinks that's weird because that's not a thing really.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess, I mean, Lady True's kind of an expert on memory, right? She came up with nostalgia, so maybe she would know. I don't know.
Yeah, it calls into question something weird about Kyle, I guess.
Yeah.
So we cut to Agent Blake tied to a chair in the Calvary compound. It looked,
all right, well, real quick, we missed, they discuss Bien, and they discuss her daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
And Lady True basically tells her, she's like, oh, she's not my daughter, she's my mother. So she said that before her mother died, or shortly after her mother died, I think, she had her mother's memories harvested and I assume turned into nostalgia, or I'm not sure. And then she cloned her mother and she, I assume, came back as a baby or whatever. And that's what Bien is. And she is slowly feeding her memories back into her so that when she becomes an adult, she will be Lady True's mother again with all of her memories, which jives with what she said earlier, where Bien said, I have these dreams sometimes. They feel so real. I'm an old woman. I'm scared and it hurts. So Lady True, she basically mentions, she said she's going to achieve her life's goal. She's going to turn on the millennium clock. She's going to save humanity. And she says, is it wrong to want my parents here when I complete my life's work? And Angela kind of questions her. She says, oh, well, if Bien is your mom, she says, your dad's here too, question mark. And Lady True says, he will be. And then it cuts to Agent Blake tied in a chair.
I don't know how important that piece of it is, I guess.
It's very, very important.
Well, they didn't really demonstrate that, but
we'll talk about it at the end.
Okay. So yeah, she's tied up in with the Calvary folks.
She being Agent Blake.
Blake, yes. We see Senator Keene approach her, and they banter about Joe's plan and why he brought her to Tulsa. And Blake says she doesn't give a shit.
I love that. She's like, she was like, basically, don't do the Bond villain thing and tell me your whole plan. Like, I just don't care. Like, you guys are clearly just stupid racist. I don't want to hear your manifesto. I don't want to hear anything. Like, just leave me alone, right?
Yeah. So, and then Joe says, it's extremely difficult being a white man in America right now, which is like such a classic.
Such like, a great line.
Right wing.
Yep.
Gesture. And then he says, so I thought I might try being a blue one. And
and just like record scratch, like mic drop, like what the fuck?
Yeah, that was right? That was pretty great because you know what he's talking about. He's gonna like try to become Dr. Manhattan. And he's gonna try to do it with very white supremacist intentions, I guess. But yeah, that's pretty funny.
I know that line that he says is extremely difficult to be a white man in America right now. I know it because it's 2023 when we're recording this, and that's very apropos right now. Like, that's all over the news. You got to remember, this show came out in 2019. Things were it was a very different world back then. I mean, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was still divided back then, but this line was, I want to say, almost prophetic, because when he said it at the time, you're like, okay, yeah, sure. It's just the fringe maybe that believes that. Okay, clearly this guy's crazy. It's looking at it through the lens of 2023, where a lot more people think that, it takes on kind of a different tone.
Yeah, I guess I don't. I do think that there probably was definitely a different overtone happening across this show. Yeah, so I can't really picture that. I do, but you know, that sort of thread of like White Grievance has been around for a very long time. And it has been very thriving since like 2015 or 2016, right. I would say, on, you know, especially online. I guess not as much in mainstream, but yeah. Like when Trump got elected in 2016, you saw kind of the woodwork come out.
Oh, sure. Then, yeah.
Like as far as like being more, way more comfortable with White Grievance and white supremacy. And so the years leading up to that, I don't know if I just, I don't know. I didn't watch this then, but I definitely can agree that it had a different tone to it, or it had a probably a very much different feel with Trump being president, you know, in that time, like as this show's coming out, it probably felt way more threatening, I would think, or, you know, yeah, I mean, it's still threatening, but I don't know. It's, yeah,
but we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, it's just I get what you're saying, but yeah, anyway.
Ultimately, I mean, like Jane was mentioning earlier, the plan was, the plan was that they wanted to get Senator Keene elected president, but then perhaps they realized that being president wasn't setting the bar high enough.
Oh, right.
I think is what she said earlier.
Yeah.
And so now we realize that the only thing more powerful than the president of the United States, perhaps, is becoming Dr. Manhattan. Becoming, if you can't be a white man in America, then be a blue one, right?
Yeah.
The next scene, we see Angela watching Lady True. She's giving her Millennium Clock speech. They are, I believe, now 4 hours away from turning on the Millennium Clock. And Lady True talks about how, you know, I forget, at age 24, she had revolutionized medicine and biotech. And, you know, she's just basically giving her resume, talking about how amazing she was. I think at one point she says she graduated, was it Harvard or MIT? And then 4 years later, she bought the company. Like, I mean, the ego on this lady and her power and money are pretty unparalleled in this universe. I think Angela gets up and she tracks down the door where that tube that she's going, that is still hooked up to her arm, is going. And she pounds on the door and she yells, she, you know, really wants to talk to her grandfather. She's like, why want me to see all those memories? And she's yelling at him and, you know, come out here and talk to me. And this is bullshit. And, you know, but it doesn't go anywhere. It's just a, you know, metal door. And she picks up a rock and she breaks like the touch screen, the fingerprint scanner or palm scanner, and the door opens, which my first thought was like, really? Like Lady True, like this super high tech place, all you got to do is break this glass and the door opens wide, but whatever. So Angela walks in and she's expecting, you know, to see her grandfather and have a discussion with him. And she walks in and she, you know, it's cement floor and there's a cage there and she sees an elephant that is lying on its side, in essence, asleep. So this elephant is sedated. And the rubber tube that's in her arm is hooked up to this elephant. And she kind of loses it because that's really alarming, right? She's expecting to see her grandfather, and she sees an elephant instead. She rips the IV out of her arm, which causes her kind of to freak out, and her memories get all mixed up, you know, once the tube is ripped out of her arm. And, well, before I go on, does the fact that she's hooked up to an elephant, does that mean anything to you?
It's just weirdness, but also, I guess, elephants are known to have good memories, so.
Exactly. So, and I looked it up, and I believe it may just be a wives' tale. I mean, according to Wikipedia, they do have, you know, the capacity for memory, but there is, it's sort of known in folklore that elephants have good memories or large memories or whatever. So I believe what they're trying to say here is that they are draining off the memories, Will's memories from Angela's brain and putting them into this elephant because they need a vessel perhaps that's large enough that can hold this. I'm not sure. It's not super clear, but it's just worth noting that elephants are sort of known to have good memories, and I think that's what this is a reference to.
Mm-hmm.
After Angela rips the IV out of her arm, like I said, her memories get a little mixed up, and it cuts, and we see June. We see Will's wife, and she is picking up Angela from the orphanage in Vietnam. And she takes Angela to a restaurant, and the restaurant is called Burgers and Borscht, which I thought was funny. Hmm. Basically, she mentions that June cut things off with her son, which would have been Angela's dad, because he wanted to run off and put on a uniform and fight. He joined the army. And I think June is a little bit, you know, sort of, she's still got some trauma about people, you know, putting on uniforms and fighting and violence. And it's caused a lot of upheaval in her life. She lost her husband to that. She hasn't seen Will in years. And, you know, now her son wants to go off and join the army, and she may or may not ever see him again. So she's a little, she cut things off with her son. She decided that that wasn't a good idea, and she wrote a letter to the army, you know, to have it delivered to her son. You know, I think she said she was apologizing, and the letter got returned, and it said that he was deceased. And that was when she found out that her son had died in this explosion. And she found out that she had a granddaughter, which is Angela, and that she decided to come and adopt her. So she has flown over from Tulsa in the United States to Vietnam to adopt young Angela. She goes on to mention, she asks what Angela has in her bag. Or actually, she says, they're just making conversation. Young Angela tells her she wants to be a police officer. And I think, like, June is a little conflicted because, you know, I mean, her ex-husband, I don't know what they are anymore, was a police officer, right? You know, she wants to be, you know, encouraging for this new granddaughter. She wants to start a relationship, right? But at the same time, you know, the police officers and masked vigilantes and now the army, like all of these service organizations, they're dangerous. And they've really turned June's life upside down. She's lost a ton of family members to this. So when her, you know, granddaughter says she wants to go and be a police officer, like, June, she's like, oh, she's encouraging, but like, you can tell, like, she's gritting through her teeth, like, oh, geez, not again, right? Ultimately, he says, she shows her the Sister Night tape. I don't know how Angela has acquired it, but while she's in this orphanage, she has acquired this VHS tape of Sister Night. She shows it to June. June is excited. She says, oh, I remember that one. That sounds great. Have you watched it? Or, you know, what did you think? And Angela says, well, I don't know. I haven't been able to watch it because my parents told me that it was not okay to watch this movie and masks are scary, blah, blah, blah. And the scene ends at this burger and borscht joint when young Angela asks, she says, well, if you're my grandma, does that mean I have a grandpa too? And June changes the subject very quickly. She doesn't even really acknowledge that Will exists. So we know that obviously that Will is still alive and he's out doing things. But as far as June is concerned, they are still not talking. And then we see June, they're outside of the restaurant, and she has put young Angela in the car, and they're, you know, she's going to take her, I assume, to the airport to take her home and adopt her and raise her. And then she puts Angela in the car. She walks around to the other side and has a heart attack, like in the street right there in the middle of this busy street, and dies. And that's the end of it. And it cuts to Angela gets out of the car and she walks to see, you know, her, you know, newly discovered grandmother collapsed on the street, dying or dead. It's hard to say. And that's where the scene ends, is like young Angela. So she's still like reliving some of these memories. And I did note that while Angela is, looking at her grandmother on the street, on the wall, on a building behind her is, you know, a painting of Dr. Manhattan. And somebody has graffitied over the top of Dr. Manhattan in red, and it says murderer, and they have added devil horns to it. So before, we had seen that, you know, everybody pretty much loved Dr. Manhattan. They have Dr. Manhattan parades, and Dr. Manhattan is, you know, a revered figure. Clearly not everybody loves Dr. Manhattan. There is certainly some ill will towards him as well.
There's an alarm on the intercom repeating, subject disconnected. She unhooks her arm strap thing and gets into an elevator. The elevator door opens to a weird hallway leading to a completely black area with a glowing globe. she touches it and sees a video call projected off of the globe of a person speaking Spanish, and then touches it again, and another one is speaking Arabic. She looks for Tulsa on the globe and touches it, and she sees call from Blake is projected, and it's where Blake is telling her jokes to Dr. Manhattan in the Dr. Manhattan phone booth thing. Lady T appears talking about how people beg for his help in these phone booths. Lady T says Dr. Manhattan isn't on Mars and isn't listening. She says he's right here on Earth pretending to be human. I think she says in Tulsa specifically.
It's worth noting that she walks in while Angela's clicking around and listening to all these stories and, you know, questions that people have sent to Dr. Manhattan, and her line is so many unanswered prayers. So you have to remember, so Lady True runs this network of phone booths, and she apparently knows that Dr. Manhattan's not on Mars, but she's in essence running this facade of all these phone booths of sending your message to Mars. I don't know, it's just kind of interesting where she was like, yeah, just so many unanswered prayers. Dr. Manhattan doesn't care. Like, well, if he doesn't care, then why are you running all these phone booths? Why are you putting so much time and effort into this, right?
Yeah, that's weird. Lady T starts talking about, like, the 7th Cavalry are going to capture and kill Dr. Manhattan and become him. Lady T... So Angela walks away at that point, and Lady True asks, or tells Angela, or kind of questions her, like, why she didn't ask who Dr. Manhattan was. At this point, I had a strong suspicion it was Cal. Is maybe Dr. Manhattan, or as definitely has something to do with it, because they've referenced him in weird ways in this episode. And also, Cal, the name Cal is significant because of Cal-El, which obviously Dr. Manhattan is a bit of a reference to Superman, and, you know, a super powerful being alien.
I mean, there was a Superman reference in what, the last episode? Yeah, right.
So that just stood out, I guess. So Angela is driving out of the compound and Red Scare and...
All right. Hang on. Okay. We got to go back a little
sorry.
Bit. Lady True is telling her all this stuff, and Angela is, I would say, rather incredulous. She's got a good poker face, but she's just, like, not having anything Lady True says. And she just basically storms off. She's like, I think she says, that's the craziest shit I've ever heard, and just starts to walk out the door. And Lady True is like, really? That's your response to this? Like, I just dropped this major bomb on you that Dr. Manhattan is alive here in Tulsa, and you don't ask me who it is, you don't care.
Yeah,
and like Lady True, like, really wants to tell Angela who Dr. Manhattan is, and Angela's just like, "Lady, you are so batshit insane. I don't want to hear anything you have to say." And the only thing I want to put the actual quote in it. Lady True says, "In less than an hour, they're going to capture Dr. Manhattan and they're going to destroy him, and then they're going to become him. Can you imagine that kind of power in the hands of white supremacists?" So we're getting like a little bit of a hint. So not only is Lady True aware of whatever weirdness that Senator Keene and the Crawfords are up to, but she's actively working on a plan to stop them and, we assume, save humanity. So this is the threat against humanity, is that these horribly racist people want to become, you know, in essence, omnipotent. So we're getting an idea that Lady True, she's got some, I don't know what the word is, she's got eyes on things that you wouldn't think that she should have eyes on. And then we cut to, like you said, the exterior gate where Pirate Jenny and Red Scare are guarding the exit. Do you want to talk about this last scene?
So the last scene, she drives home and runs into her house, and we see some 7th Cavalry people outside watching her house.
Across the street, they're surveilling her house, right?
Yeah, so just kind of stakeout, monitoring. And Angela comes into the house searching the cupboards, Cal comes in wondering what she's doing.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there real quick.
Go ahead. And
The scene opens and Cal is asleep on the couch. And there's a book open, so he's fallen asleep on the couch reading a book. And the book that he's reading is For Whom the Bell Tolls. And one of the major themes of For Whom the Bell Tolls is the role of love and relationships in a time of extreme crisis. So anytime there's like a headline on a newspaper or a book, like it's almost always a reference to what's going on in the plot. I had to look up, I mean, full disclosure, I had to look up For Whom the Bell Tolls and what it's about. But it's interesting that it's about love and relationships during crisis. But like you said, Cal ultimately wakes up because he hears Angela in the kitchen. So go ahead, I'll let you finish up.
She says he was a great husband and loves him and all of that. And then says it's time to come out of the tunnel holding a hammer. And Cal says, what tunnel? And she tells him there was no accident. It was his idea. And she whacks him in the head with a hammer and starts fucking brutally.
She calls him John first.
Oh, okay.
She says, time to come out of the tunnel. And she calls him John. And he looks at her like she's crazy. So from Cal's point of view, she's been in the hospital and she just OD'd on drugs and she's talking about crazy stuff. And he was like, what in the hell is going on? You're calling me by the wrong name. You're telling me things that are happening that clearly have not happened. Like, he's very skeptical of what she's doing because of where she's been. And she calls him John. And it's worth noting that Dr. Manhattan's first name is John. So that's where that comes from. And yes, so she calls him John. She hits him in the head with a hammer. And then, go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to steal your thunder.
So she whacks him in the head with a hammer and starts like digging with the hammer into his skull and pulls out a ring with like a small sphere floating in the middle. And then basically, at the end, she says, hey, baby, we're in fucking trouble. And that's it.
She pulls this out, like, it's really gross. Like, they did a good job on the effects. Like, she digs into what's with his skull, right? And pulls out this ring with a little ball floating in the middle of it, right? And like you said, she says, you know, we're in trouble. And her face glows blue a little bit, you know? I mean, clearly blue is the Dr. Manhattan color. And the item that she pulls out of his brain or skull or whatever is, you know, a 3D printed essentially version of the hydrogen symbol, which is the Dr. Manhattan symbol. It's the element that he has on his, that he brands on his temple. So this is all clearly a reference to Dr. Manhattan. And then that's it. And then the music, the credits roll and the music starts. Did you note what the music was?
I did not.
I spent like a solid 15 minutes looking up what this music was. I had Google, do you recognize this tune? I couldn't find it anywhere on the internet. It's a really like kind of haunting, weird tune. And so I called in the experts. I called Doug because he's all things music. And he pointed out that the music, and this is like chef's kiss perfect music, the music is Life on Mars by David Bowie. So it ends with a song about someone living on Mars, which clearly is where Dr. Manhattan maybe is or isn't. It's a very Dr. Manhattan-esque reference, I should say, at minimum. And then that's it. And that's what we see. So the episode ends. Angela has essentially killed Cal, pulled something out of his brain, and the 7th Cavalry are outside. So,
Yeah.
Question mark, right? Two episodes to go. What's how's your list of questions looking? Have we answered anything?
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of abandoned the list at this point.
Is that good or bad? Like so many are answered, or you just have given up?
A lot is answered, but it just doesn't seem to matter as much, you know? Like, a lot of things just aren't going to be explained, and so, like, there's this... I think the filmmaking, and I think maybe, you know, David Lindelof, you know, purposely has this effect on what he's doing is trying to confuse you as much as possible in these elements that, like, don't make sense, and they're purposefully kind of glaringly don't make sense. And some of them get explained and some of them don't. And so I think the ultimate purpose is like just not to care as much and just kind of go along for the ride, you know, and not worry too much about like all the little details or all the little weird things, the red herrings that are thrown out, you know. I don't think you're supposed to really kind of needle into like what's a red herring and what's not, you know. I don't know. So I'm having a hard time.
There's a fair amount. I mean, there certainly are red herrings, but I will give them props. There are very few red herrings compared to the amount of things that are explained. I would have expected a lot of things not to have made sense or been. I would have expected that when the show was over, there were more red herrings, but I was satisfied at the end. So they do a good job of keeping it mysterious without, you know, making it overwhelming.
Yeah. I guess, you know, I'm still like not sure about the show, you know, and I feel like I will be sure at the end. I feel like, yeah, at the we'll have a good payoff. I'm getting more and more confident about that. And as things roll on, we're seeing more explanations about like specifically Angela's character and like her grandpa Will, and there's some in-depth characters there.
Okay, so I want to ask you two questions, and you didn't pick up on this. I'm going to ask you. Let's see. Hang on. Lady Trube mentions that Bien is her mother, right? And that she has essentially cloned her mom because she wants her parents to be with her when she, you know, achieves her life's goal, which is to start up this millennium clock. And Angela says, "Oh, your dad too. He's here too." And she says, "He will be soon." So I'm curious if you have, do you have a guess on what she's talking about when she's talking about her father being here soon? I don't expect you to. I'm just, I want you to make a wild guess just because I'm curious.
Well, now that you ask me that question, like it matters. I guess I don't think it matters in the show at this point, but it probably will matter.
Like it absolutely matters.
I think she's Asian. I think she's interested in the Saigon history of Angela. Like they were talking about her coming from Saigon, so maybe it has something to do with Vietnam. Maybe it's the guy that did the kamikaze, or the,
oh, interesting. Okay.
The, what do you call that? Sorry.
The suicide bomber. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your reaction tells me that's not right, but that's a weird
guess. I'm not going to tell you either way. I'm just, there's absolutely no way you could really know.
I don't
curious.
Think there is a way. And I think I am perfectly capable of picking up on clues in a series that are meant to tell you something. And I don't think, like, I am really, I feel like I have that ability to pick up on clues in shows and like, and understand what they're trying to tell me. And so far in the show, nothing about her father, you know, exists, I don't think, at all. And I don't think it's supposed to matter yet. I mean, there was that one scene of them talking about it slightly. And so, yes, maybe, but there's no other references anywhere in the show that I'm aware of. I could be wrong.
I don't want you to feel like you're dumb and you've missed out, because you absolutely have not. I'm just curious because I know where it goes. I'm curious if you had a thought.
Yeah, I just don't know why.
There's no right or wrong answer to
it. It's important at this point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have a theory about what's happening with Angela and Cal? I mean, she murders him at the end.
Yeah, I think like Cal is like a clone of Dr. Manhattan, or is like some sort of vessel, or like hiding Dr. Manhattan. Like it was a disguise, or like is hiding him somehow. I think that little symbol thing means that, oh, she's unleashing Dr. Manhattan, the real person, the real Dr. Manhattan now. Like she's breaking the glass open, so to speak. And like, you know, and he's definitely going to appear in the next episode. But I don't know.
And nope, you're right. Or you're not right. I mean, you're on the right track. And then Lastly, I don't know if I want to ask you because I think it might give it away. There was a reference in the last episode. Nah, I better not. Okay. All right. So we'll leave it there. The only thing that this is probably my all-time favorite show title for an episode is the title for the next for episode 8. And you're going to look it up before you watch the episode. So I will just tell you what the title is now because it's, again, chef's kiss amazing. The title of the next episode is A God Walks Into a Bar.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
So it's, you know, it's a parody of, you know, a billion, you know, a Jew and a whatever, a priest walk into a bar. But the title is A God Walks Into a Bar. So we will see certainly more about the fallout from Angela murdering Cal in the next episode. And like I said, there's 2 more episodes and then we're done and we're wrapped up and that's the end of the series. So time will tell.
Yep.
We'll have to be a little more timely with our next episode. I think we took 3 weeks between this because we got lazy, but we'll get back into it.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just realized how time consuming this show is. It took me over an hour to get like 20 minutes into this episode.
Yeah.
And I don't even think I took very good notes or did that good research. Like, I think you do better research on the show, but it takes a lot. There's a lot. It's very dense. Like, it's a 50 minute episode, this last one. And it probably took me 3 hours to get through it, you know?
Sure.
So yeah.
I maybe take better note. I've seen this show, I think, 3 or 4 times now, so I know where it goes. So I know what to look for. So I think that makes it a little easier. Like, so it's.
Yeah, I'm just trying to like capture everything that's happened.
Yeah,
I don't
really
care about references, even. I'm just trying to capture the things that are happening in the show. And there's a lot, you know? Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. We'll be back with episode 8 before too long.
Cool. All right.
Adios.